Good morning, Your Honors. Mary Nagman for the plaintiff.
Could I remind you my ears aren't working right today because of the airplane flight?
I'll speak up, Your Honor. May it please the Court. There are a few points I'd like to make with respect to the issues in this case. I need to raise the fact that the plaintiff ran away after he was stopped on July 17, 1998. That is something that no lawyer and certainly no judge would like, the fact that he ran away. However, I'd argue that in this case it didn't make any difference because there are disputed issues of material fact with respect to whether or not Defendant Hoagland had a right to detain the plaintiff on July 17, 1998.
The reason running away matters is the notion that the guilty flee where none pursueth, that gives rise to suspicion all by itself.
But I think that in the instant case, there are sufficient genuine issues of disputed facts that kind of rebut that assumption. And
is that really that critical, given that what he was ultimately charged with was not obstruction but battery?
I beg your pardon?
Is that really critical to what we're deciding today, given that what your client was ultimately charged with was battery and not obstruction?
Well, I think it goes to the fact that summary judgment was granted based on the fact that the district court, I believe, found that there were genuine issues of disputed fact with respect to whether or not there was a battery on the police officer, but held that it didn't matter anyhow because there was a reasonable reasonable grounds or probable cause to arrest on the 148 PC of delaying and obstructing. So whether or not there was at the outset either a reasonable a detention and or an arrest with probable cause is germane to these issues. And I'd argue that there are many factors in this that point to the fact that there wasn't a proper detention and or arrest. I characterize the second encounter Defendant Hoagland had with the plaintiff on July 17, 1998, as an arrest that has the indicia of arrests. But you have to also look at the fact that a week and a half prior to the July 17, 1998 incident, Defendant Hoagland stops the plaintiff, makes him show his ID, runs his ID, has him in front of his car on the hood.
What's the matter with that? Kid looks like he's under the curfew age, so the cop stops him and checks him to find out.
That earlier encounter is not an issue in this case from the standpoint of whether or not he thought he was underage or not. But what it establishes is that Defendant Hoagland had met with Defendant Troy a week and a half earlier, and he's a police officer and should be able to retain in his memory that meeting. He looks at the ID of Mr. Troy. He sees that he's over 18.
Good. If I see you on the street a week and a half from now, I won't recognize you. I won't remember.
Well, I think that you're not in the position of that particular police officer who's actually stopping these two young men, and he does know who they are because later he goes to the cousin, Moses Andaro, to get plaintiff's address. So he knew perfectly well who they were. And it does make a difference because he's a police officer trained to recognize, trained to look at identifications, and he doesn't spend a little amount of time. He has the police officer's lights, the patrol car's lights trained on the plaintiff. So what I'm saying is there's a good probability that he did know who the plaintiff was and knew that he was over 18 when he stops the plaintiff on July 17th, 1998. A second factor is that
he hadn't seen his identification.
I beg your pardon?
I thought he had not seen his identification.
Well, the week and a half earlier stop, there's a stop a week and a half before July 17th, and I'll point that's at, I think I have the, ER 5758, Mr. Choi's declaration. A week and a half earlier, he looks at Mr. Choi's declaration, identification, stops Mr. Choi, and actually gets out of his car and throws the identification on the ground and tells Mr. Choi and his cousin to get the hell out of there. All indicia of racial profiling, that he would recollect that this was a went on July 17th, that this was a person he'd seen a week and a half earlier, and that maybe he had it in for Mr. Choi.
What was the race aspect? I couldn't see it. It looked like
well, the race aspect.
Choi had been making himself a person of interest to this policeman, and there's nothing about race that distinguishes him from anyone else. What distinguishes him from anyone else is that he keeps hanging around and not doing what the cop says.
Well, I'm not quite sure what Your Honor means when you say he keeps hanging around and doesn't do what the cop says.
Cop keeps seeing him, and he tells him to leave, and the kid doesn't leave.
He's not a kid. He's a 24-year-old
adult.
The kid
doesn't stay.
He's a 24-year-old adult, and after he's told to disperse, he waits a minute or two and then starts to leave, and he's walking off, and he's stopped by Mr. Hoagland. So I don't think it can be said that he's not doing what the police officer said. The police
what evidence
officer,
is there that he's treated differently from other people who act the same way, except they're of some race that the policeman prefers?
He's being treated differently because, first of all, he's the only person who's stopped and actually arrested. The other people are just left to go.
I thought the others were all girls, and they all left and went home.
They don't leave to go home until Mr. Hoagland crosses the street to tell them to get Mr. Choir. So they're not. There's another issue, too, and that is that Mr. Hoagland's sole basis for singling out Mr. Choi, according to him, is that Mr. Choi said that he was 17 years old, and that's in Mr. Hoagland's declaration, and that he didn't live at that particular place on Park Place. But that's a disputed issue of material fact. Mr. Hoagland at the trial said that he's at the criminal trial of Mr. Choi said that Mr. Choi was walking down the street with three females. Doesn't say anything about the race. All of a sudden, in this case, the three females become four females. That's in Mr. Hoagland's declaration. I think that's at around 108, 110. They become four black females. And that's controverted by Mr. Choi because Mr. Choi, in his declaration, stated that there were four Hispanic young women and one white woman. So there is a black issue here that is actually, there's evidence of it from the encounter that existed prior to the July 17th case incident, which is the subject of this case. So I think there are racial issues in this, and that what you see is a continuing attempt to calls the arrest and prosecution of Mr. Choya, that is race-based. You have the fact that Mr. Choya denies pushing Mr. Hoagland.
What I heard you say is Choya is distinguished from the people with him in several respects. His sex, his race, and possibly his conformity to the policeman's orders. And you're assuming it's race that leads to the arrest.
Well, I think that's one of the bases. There are the other basis is, of course, that there may just have been a simple vindictiveness against Mr. Choya that's evidenced by the fact that Mr. Hoagland had seen him just a week and a half before. A month later, after the July 17th.
Well, now that would, it seemed to me, work against you. If the policeman is out to get Chwaya because he thinks he's a local troublemaker, that's not racial.
But there's no evidence in the record, nor is there any evidence, that Mr. Chwaya was anything other than a regular young guy walking down the street, or that he was a troublemaker, or that he had any engagement.
No prior criminal record.
Excuse me. There is a...
He was smart with the policeman a couple of times.
I beg your pardon?
He was smart with the policeman a couple of times. That tends to be how they define troublemakers.
Well, the smart with the police officer, he was not smart with the police officer on the encounter a week and a half earlier. He was not smart with the police officer on July 17th, 1998, because he was trying to show him his identification. I don't think that would be considered to be smart to a police officer, because the police officer refused to look at the ID. If he'd looked at the identification, then it would have become immediately apparent that the curfew statute didn't apply to him. I mean, the whole point is that Mr. Hoagland's basing his reasonable suspicion, or I would say actually probable cause, because I believe he conducted a Terry stop when he first went across the street and told them to disperse. And he says, I asked them their ages. He says, Troy said, well, I'm 17 years old. Troy denies that. But oh. I would say that the subsequent encounter on July 17th, I have to keep giving the dates because of this other arrest, amounted to an arrest without probable cause. And because Mr. Troy did try to show his identification, it would have been the easiest thing in the world just to look at the identification.
Let me move you over to another area before we run out of time.
Okay.
That concerns me. On the malicious prosecution claim, there's something that confuses me there. The theory is that the policeman engaged in a malicious prosecution in the criminal case. But as I understand it, policemen don't prosecute. All they are is complaining witnesses.
Right.
It's like the victim of a crime who's the complaining witness, and then the jury thinks that the victim lied or the victim misidentified the criminal. Victim lied about some critical element of whether that made it a crime or not. Since policeman doesn't have the power to prosecute for a crime and is merely a complaining witness, how do you make out the elements of the tort?
Well, the elements I think are made out because a false arrest report was filed, stating it's a genuine issue of material fact whether a false report was filed. And that false report.
What are the elements of the tort in California?
I'll have it for you in just a second. All right. I think it's governed by Usher.
I know what the policeman did wrong under your theory, but my concern is, what are the elements of the tort?
I think it's governed by, I'll have it in just a second. I have it here. It's in the reply brief, and the elements relate are, in California, the elements of malicious prosecution are, one, the initiation of criminal prosecution, malicious motivation, and lack of probable cause, and that's the plaintiff's reply brief at 23.
How do you get number one, initiation of prosecution, when a policeman can't initiate a prosecution? A district attorney has to initiate the prosecution.
If they illegally arrest plaintiff on a particular charge, they contrive charges to justify the arrest and then submit false police reports to the prosecutor, that ends up being that satisfies that element, I believe.
Fair case that says that?
I believe that's actually cited in the, I think we have a case to that effect in the first, in the opening brief. Uh, Logan v. Caterpillar, that's 246 F. 3rd, 912, 7th Circuit, 2001, denying summary judgment on plaintiff's claim that the defendant gave the police false information that resulted in the plaintiff being criminally prosecuted. So in this case, it's the police officer himself. He's giving the prosecutor false information that resulted in the plaintiff being criminally prosecuted.
So you're saying he lies about the whole incident to begin with, which starts the whole ball of wax in the first place?
I beg your pardon?
It's lying about the whole incident, what you claim Hogan does, is what results in charges being filed. Is that what you're saying?
I think a little more, basically, yes. With respect to the charge of battery on a police officer, most certainly, because you have an independent witness, you have Mr. Troyer going out to the neighborhood to look for independent witnesses, and that is a good, that's not something somebody who's pushed a police officer is usually going to do. And that's in Mr. Kressler's testimony. I think that's the ER 81, 82, so ER 81 through 88, that he had done that, and therefore, and Mr. Kressler, no, he didn't push the police officer. He did run away. He went away, and that's that. So I don't think that I think that's a genuine issue of disputed material fact. I think that there is grounds for the claim, malicious prosecution claim, to go forward based on that. If the court has any other questions, otherwise I'll reserve.
I don't
have any more. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning.
I'm sorry.
Sylvia Havens appearing on.
Clarify for me, this came up by virtue of a motion for summary judgment on qualified immunity?
It came, yes, part one, no, part two. Yes, on motion for summary judgment, the court found no constitutional violation.
Right, but it was basically you were urging qualified immunity as the defense here, right?
That was one of the defenses that was raised. Under the Saussure, of course, you have to address first whether there was a constitutional
right.
violation.
And that's how this was being analyzed, was under qualified immunity.
I believe that the order is that there was no constitutional violation.
Right, but that would be the first prong of the Saussure analysis, right?
It is the first prong, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because on page 9 of the district court's decision, he says, in order to establish whether the individual defendant, the district court says, whether the individual defendant should receive qualified immunity, the court must consider whether the law governing the official's conduct was clearly established. And so that's all he really ruled on.
It was Judge Cooper, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
But
I'm getting the two judges confused today.
You don't get to qualified immunity if there's no constitutional
right.
violation. You don't need immunity if you've made no reasonable mistake for which qualified immunity.
And that's what concerns me the most about this is actually with respect to the malicious prosecution claim, because that was a Section 1983 malicious prosecution claim that they brought, right?
It was, Your Honor, yes.
Isn't it clearly established that the police violate constitutional rights if they fabricate a charge against you and make you stand trial for that charge?
Well, I believe the way that was analyzed is I think Judge Cooper took it, what she found was that there was probable cause for the, I think that was her order. But looking at each of the elements, there's actually four elements. The first, they did not initiate it. The falsification of reports, there was actually a claim for falsification of reports. That was dismissed on a 12b-6. It's not on appeal. So we're not talking about
the malicious prosecution. That's
correct. And you can't, the malicious prosecution is different than a falsification of report claim. So we don't have a falsification of report claim. We do have a malicious prosecution claim, which has
the question we really should be analyzing is whether, this is why I'm going back to the qualified immunity, whether Hoagland and Cabrera have qualified immunity against the malicious prosecution claim.
Well, I think you also have to analyze whether the elements of a malicious prosecution were met.
That wasn't the question that was presented to the district court. The question was whether there was qualified immunity.
I believe that, and I can double-check, I'm not 100% positive, but the motion for summary judgment was not brought solely on qualified immunity.
Well, that's what it was brought on. Says. The district court says it's ruling on qualified immunity at page 9 of its opinion. And that's what I found confusing about this.
I that might have been her angle, her approach. That doesn't mean that
that's the ruling that's being appealed. So that's what we have to look at is what she said, right?
Well, we look at the undisputed facts, material facts, whether there are disputed facts and whether or not the malicious prosecution claim can survive even under a different reason.
Yeah, it could be you would look at that, too, but you would also look at whether she applied the law of qualified immunity correctly here.
If it can be affirmed for any reason aside from the reason stated, there's nothing to prevent this court from affirming summary judgment on the malicious prosecution claim, even if it's not on a qualified immunity provided.
This strikes me as wrong with saying that it's not clearly established that police officers should not fabricate arrest reports.
And I think that's a very safe, that's a safe statement. I think it is. But I don't think that in any way impacts summary judgment, the propriety of summary judgment being granted on the malicious prosecution claim, because we have four elements.
I'm just puzzled by it. In Usher, the court slid right past the issue that I raised. It looks as though nobody raised it, so they just assumed that when a policeman submits a false report that leads to an unfounded prosecution, that the policeman initiates the prosecution, even though it's just not how prosecutions get initiated. But they seem to assume it. I'm wondering if there's some other constitutional tort where a policeman lies to the prosecutor and causes the prosecutor to prosecute, say, an innocent man.
Well, that could be classified as a falsification of report claim, which has been dismissed in this case wasn't pursued. Not before this court, and honestly, I didn't delve into...
My impression is that there's a problem with that and a reason why that's not done, and that is that there are a lot of cases where a criminal prosecution falls apart for one reason or another, and it looks as though the complaining witness lied, and that they virtually never, in my experience anyway, prosecute the lying complaining witness.
And there's a very good reason for that.
I think there's some kind of immunity for that.
Immunity, absolute immunity. And you need to, for public policy reasons, you need to hold that sacred. It's not just the officer taking
the
stand.
Why isn't the policeman protected by that absolute immunity the same way as, say, as if he was innocent, Kobe Bryant's accuser would be protected?
I think there's cases cited in the answering brief that to that effect. U.S. Supreme Court case, I can give the cite, but it's in the Briscoe versus LaHue. Supreme Court pointed out that the same danger exists in the case of potential liability for police officer witnesses. And it was discussing the immunity when an officer takes the stand. And I do think that that's the situation that we have here.
Taking the stand is different.
It is. Didn't actually, and that's why we do have three different defendants, and it needs to be borne in mind that
lying to the prosecutor to cause him to prosecute is what I'm focusing on.
Okay, and just for all of the causes of action, we're really just talking for this particular angle about Deputy Hoagland. Daphne Cabrera didn't falsify any report allegedly.
As I understand it, Hoagland was the one who recited the battery to Cabrera, and Cabrera just wrote it down.
I'm sorry.
What are the facts as to what Cabrera did?
Cabrera was not there at the scene at the time of the Terry stop. Deputy Hoagland came back And I forget if he actually wrote a report or issued. I don't think the arrest warrant was made at that time, but he reported to his partner, Deputy Cabrera, what had happened. He then spoke with the plaintiff's mother. The plaintiff came into the station. Deputy Cabrera, he was identified to Deputy Cabrera. Deputy Cabrera said,
I can't follow what you're saying. I thought Hoagland said, Chuaya pushed me.
Wrote a report.
And that's what the prosecution is based on. Hoagland says, Chuaya pushed me. Nobody else saw it except Chuaya and Hoagland.
Correct.
And the issue is, correct, if Hoagland was, and the prosecution was battery based on Chuaya pushing Hoagland. And the question is, if Hoagland lied when he said, Chuaya pushed me, is a 1983 tort made out? Is there any more to it? You're telling us a lot of other facts.
Well, I was
answering. And I can't figure out how they have any relevance.
As to Deputy Cabrera, they have tremendous relevance. He's being sued for malicious prosecution as well.
Had no personal knowledge.
He does not, and that's why he should be out for completely and totally different reasons.
Judge Kleinfeld is saying, if you just said that, that'd be a really good answer. We wouldn't spend 5 minutes on it.
Okay.
But how do you distinguish the Allwright v. Oliver case, where Justice Ginsburg said, you know, a person facing serious criminal charges is hardly freed from the state's control upon his release from a police officer's physical grip? You know, and she goes on to talk about how it is a constitutional tort for a police officer to to create a false report that causes a person to stand trial when they otherwise wouldn't. And there's a distinction in the case law between that being the immediate cause of the deprivation of the constitutional right and perjuring oneself on the stand. I understand that there's probably absolute immunity for lying on the witness stand, but not for this, you know, causing the whole trial to occur, because you're depriving the person of their freedom simply by making the false charges.
I'd like to respond to that in specific context of what we've got here. We've got a malicious prosecution claim.
The Section 1983 malicious prosecution.
Correct, in which none of the elements are met. They didn't initiate it. If you're talking about whether or not there can be other claims, et cetera, that aren't before this court, I suppose we can go off into a discussion of that.
But this
malicious
prosecution. I actually think this is the strongest argument that the plaintiff has here, and I actually think it's probably a good one. It seems to me that this is just another, you know, walking around while black and bellflower case. And that happens all the time. So I'm trying to figure out whether this is that particular case and whether the police should be held accountable.
Well, in this situation, Sheriff Baca, not involved. Deputy Cabrera, not involved. Malicious prosecution, Deputy Hoagland didn't initiate it. There is no favorable termination on the merits. There was a hung jury. And it was dismissed after that, but not that there was a hung jury. It is not a favorable termination.
A dismissal doesn't count?
Not following a hung jury. A dismissal for lack of evidence, if the court found that there was a lack of evidence, but that's not what happened here. There's a full prosecution.
Do you have cases in point on two of those propositions? Number one, that it's not initiation of a prosecution for the policeman to make a false report to the prosecutor. And number two, for the proposition that it's not a favorable termination on the merits if the case is dismissed after a hung jury. Tell me the names of the cases.
Don't have them offhand. I'd be more than willing to do supplemental briefing if
Your chance for briefing was when you filed your brief, actually. If we want more briefs, we'll tell you.
Okay.
Isn't Cabrera's problem that the plaintiff alleges that once Hoagland makes a false report, Cabrera goes along with it and also claims that their statements made that weren't made?
The first prong, what is Deputy Cabrera supposed to do? Going along with it, he's got an officer telling him that
But Cabrera claims that he hears a conversation that the plaintiff denies he ever had.
I believe that the record reflects that Cabrero heard the conversation that plaintiff admits to. Plaintiff, his declaration, he says that in riding in the police car, he said that he was sorry that he ran away. He was sorry for what happened. Deputy Cabrero testifies that he was sorry that he ran away. During the criminal prosecution, Deputy Cabrero was specifically asked, did he apologize for running away? Yes, he did. Did he apologize for pushing Detective Hoagland? No, he did not. So is it inconsistent to say at one point he apologized for what happened in a declaration versus in a criminal testimony? Did he apologize? Yes, he did, for running away. In my opinion, that is absolutely not contradictory. Plaintiff admits that he apologized for running away. Entirely consistent testimony. So Deputy Cabrero did nothing other than report what plaintiff admits.
You're talking about disputed facts, and this is a summary judgment against the plaintiff, and so we look at all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
And that's why we have conceded plaintiff's deposition testimony, and I can go through everything he concedes. All material facts are from his deposition testimony. We are not attempting to dispute any facts. He admits he was there after 10. He admits he was in a group of people that looked like they were underage. He admits that he was asked to leave. Something that if he was being targeted, an officer doesn't say move along, get home, to somebody that he believes is underage. He admits that he was walked across the street. He admits that he ran after he was walked across the street. There's reasonable suspicions to stop him that he admits.
That he committed battery, and that was the thing that he was charged with.
Yes, Your Honor. And as to that, there is a disputed fact. I don't believe that supports the malicious prosecution claim. The falsification of report claim was dismissed and not appealed.
Well, it's a disputed fact whether he pushed the cop, isn't it? He says he didn't. The cop says he did.
But he was arrested for both 148 and battery on a police officer.
That's okay on the arrest, but the prosecution was just for pushing the cop, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the prosecutor elected to proceed on, completely and totally out of the control of Deputy Hoagland. Any other questions? I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
On the malicious prosecution claim, a Section 1983 malicious prosecution claim requires that the state law elements of malicious prosecution be pled and there as well be a violation of some federal right. Those are all present here. A police officer certainly can initiate a prosecution by submitting a police report to a prosecutor. If that weren't the case, you'd have the absurdity of saying that a cop can't ever initiate malicious prosecution, and only a prosecutor can. That just isn't the way it works.
Say that again. I didn't follow the argument for why that's absurd. When a client came into my law office and said, I want you to sue somebody for me, I'd say yes or I'd say no. I thought prosecutors did the same thing with policemen.
Sure they do, but nevertheless, police officers cause the initiation of a prosecution by coming into a prosecutor. If they come in with something that's baloney, they get stuck with a Section 1983 malicious prosecution claim. Police officers all the time are sued for Section 1983 malicious prosecution claims, and there is no case of which I know, and I've read a lot of them, that stands for the legal proposition that a police officer can't be sued for malicious prosecution because it's legally impossible for a police officer to initiate.
Is there a case that answers that question where the question was raised? I'm not aware of one. Usher just goes right past it. It doesn't consider it.
Usher's the law, and Usher
But
does,
Usher doesn't deal with that question. Nobody raised it.
Does go past it. My recollection is that the Ninth Circuit case of Devereaux, Devereaux versus Abbey, Abbey.
I'm real familiar with that case.
I know you are. And I think it's a 262 F3rd, or maybe 261, deals with that. For this court to hold that a police officer couldn't be a proper defendant.
I hope you're not relying on what I said in Devereaux, because I wound up on the short end.
That's why I cited it to you. There are other cases that stand for that, but I can't think of them offhand. The elements, however, are initiation or causing initiation, want of probable cause, and a favorable termination. The malice can be inferred from the want of probable cause. However, it's unclear to me whether or not malice any longer is required because it's a subjective component, and you can't have – you're not required to have or can't have a subjective component.
Let me get back to the initiation. The reason it's troubling me is that my understanding is that prosecutors really do exercise independent judgment.
Not in the world I live in. Perhaps in some other, on some other planet. Prosecutors do what cops tell them.
Alaska's not on another planet.
Pardon me?
Alaska's not on another planet.
Well, but Bellflower, is.
Close to it. I'm thinking, suppose a cop does come in to the prosecutor with two charges, A and B, and the cop thinks the case is more solid on A. The prosecutor, maybe for bad reasons, thinks it's more solid on B, and he just prosecutes on B because he thinks it will be easier.
The judgment isn't independent when the police officer misleads the prosecutor. That's the law. So the issue is, disputed issue of fact, did the police officer mislead the prosecutor? That's a disputed fact. That's an issue. The favorable termination.
Why is it any different from the plaintiff, well, like the Kobe Bryant case, plaintiff in a rape case who says it was rape, defense is consent, and the jury is back. We just have one in my town like this. The jury is back in a half hour. They say, obviously, it was consent.
Well, putting aside the fact that that was Colorado, which I don't know much about, there you have something that actually happened. There was sexual intercourse. It's a much closer case. Here there's something that never happened. Just didn't exist. There was sexual intercourse, and it's a much, much closer case. It's still an issue for the jury.
Is the complaining witness in that case subject to a malicious prosecution?
Sure. Sure. Whether or not it could ever be won, I doubt it, because it's much closer and it's got to do with people's perceptions. But this just never happened. It was made up out of whole cloth. And
the local case that I'm thinking of, that's what the jury thought happened. It was made up. It was
fabricated.
The whole thing was a lie by the complaining witness.
And I don't know what goes on in Alaska either. I've never been there.
But I thought she had an immunity.
No, you're confusing that, respectfully, I think, with Briscoe versus Lahui, which is the 1986 U.S. Supreme Court case that accords only testimonial immunity. If you do something before that, you don't reason backwards and say just because someone takes the stand and tells the same lies that they told in the police report, you reason back and it covers the police report.
I know you're right about that case being for testimonial immunity.
That's all.
And you're saying there's no immunity for the report.
That's absolutely correct. Let me quickly cover the other points. Favorable termination. I heard during the prior argument Judge Collins mentioned that he believed somebody had, there had been an 11-1 verdict. That was in this case. The jury decided 11-1 to acquit the plaintiff. The judge heard all the testimony, and then based on what the judge heard and the 11-1 of which the judge knew, the judge granted the dismissal. That's why it's a favorable termination. And that issue is met here also. There's no qualified immunity on anything because all of the facts are in dispute. And under the Saucier versus Katz analysis, there are three things you go through. One, is a constitutional violation pled? Of course there is. Two, was the law clearly established at the relevant time? Of course it was. And three, could a reasonable police officer have believed that she or he was doing that which was right and wasn't doing that which was wrong? No reasonable police officer could believe that trumping up facts and telling lies would be correct.
I think for the Saucier analysis, we assume
that
the kid did not push the cop, don't we?
Of course. Of course. So if you assume that, which you have to, because he gets the plaintiff gets the benefit of all the favorable inferences, if you assume that, it's a jury issue, and that's the end of it. So the plaintiff wins, the defendants lose, and they get to go to trial in front of Judge Cooper, which isn't all bad. I don't have anything more to say unless there are any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
You're welcome.
Choya versus Baca is submitted.